Muir, author of the Macro Tourist newsletter and Substack, and co-host of the Market Huddle. Welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me.
Oh, it's always great to be with you, Tom. I'm looking forward to this.
I'm really looking forward to it as well, Kevin. And you know, it's always interesting because we end up having such an illuminating conversation that isn't necessarily attached to, let's say, the typical topics that I end up covering. So it's always interesting to kind of dig into, you know, a lot of topics outside my realm of competence, let's say. And I think one of the most interesting things that I've been trying to read a lot about right now and wrap my head around is the SpaceX IPO kind of looming here. It seems like the by any metric, it is absolutely stretched beyond belief or beyond imagination. So could that possibly mark, I would say, the peak of market insanity?
Oh, first of all, in terms of the SpaceX pricing, insanity is not the correct word. It's absolutely just diabolically overpriced. My buddy Blind Squirrel Macro, Rupert, he's done a great job at taking it apart. And he's like, even if you assume the most optimistic things, he's having trouble getting it to half the valuation. And I trust his kind of analysis there. And when you hear the people that are long it talk about it, even the folks that love it and are excited about it in terms of its prospects, even they're kind of saying, oh geez, you know what, it's really expensive, like this is really insane. So there's just nobody is looking at this and going, this is a terrific deal in terms of it's coming out cheap and therefore we got to buy it. In terms of whether this will mark what might be an interim top in the market, I think there's a better chance than most people are assigning to that possibility. And I grabbed this from Mike Novogratz, who's a former, I think he's at Goldman Sachs and he's off on his own. And he kind of went the way of crypto for a little while, but the fellow still knows a lot about markets. And he's been talking about the fact that often peaks in markets are associated with big, huge events. And the two that he mentions is the AOL purchase of Time Warner for the dot-com bubble. And then the other one is the takeover or the handing over of the Hong Kong for the whatever, you know, that bull market. Regardless, there's often some sort of symbolic huge thing. I think there's a very good chance that that ends up being this market's top is this SpaceX IPO. And not only that, in terms of from a optical point of view, whether this is ends up being something that coincides with just peak enthusiasm, but from a pure supply point of view, when we're talking about stocks, in the past, we've had this situation where most of the time, the float of the stock market has been shrinking. And so the number of shares outstanding has been shrinking because there's a ton of buybacks and there's been very little issuance. And so we've had this situation where there's just been this, when we look at the supply demand, there's been a constant buyback that's kind of given the stock market a bit of a bid. And for the first time with this huge issuance of both SpaceX, Anthropic and OpenAI, three absolutely monstrous IPOs that are coming due this summer, we're going to have a situation where the supply of the issuance of stock is much, much higher. So one of the things that I might say is a little different in terms of my viewpoint about this is a lot of folks are saying, well, when it finally comes, that's when the market will roll over. Or they'll talk about when the lockup, meaning when the shares become free trading, that's when the market will roll over. I think there's a good chance that it's even before that. And I remember in my days when I was trading institutionally, I would see clients selling in anticipation to make room for IPOs all the time. The reality is if you're sitting there and you're Fidelity or Cap or one of these big clients and you're expecting that you're going to get a large allocation of the SpaceX IPO, you're making room. You're selling the NVIDIAs. You're selling the other stocks that are going to replace it. And mm-hmm. So I look at this, I think they're aiming for June 15th, June 19th, somewhere around there. My guess is that we're going to see weakness in the stock market even before that. You could very well see maybe this month end being the high, and that June ends up being, much to everyone's surprise, a weak month in the stock market.
Well, that's, you know, as you're explaining that, I'm wondering where the capital ends up coming from to fuel and to, you know, put into those IPOs.
Yeah, it has to come from somewhere else. Right now, there's there's a certain amount of money coming in all the time. But the reality is that if we need to have a situation where there's all this new supply, something else needs to be sold, like whether it's bonds or maybe cash on the sidelines. I hate that expression. There generally isn't a lot of them. And by the way, when we're talking about that cash on the sidelines, if you look at the Bank of America, that has one of the greatest surveys out there, it's the fund management survey, and they have been tracking what their institutional clients, you know, do and say and believe for many, many years. If you look at the amount of cash that those institutional managers are holding, it is almost at a record low, meaning that there is very little room for them to buy more, right?
Yeah, and I mean, exactly as you're saying too, from a, let's say a supply perspective, if there's very little float in the stock market because of all these buybacks and stuff, you know, that also makes me wonder how rates end up kind of playing a role here too, because if these companies need to continue to raise capital to operate, I feel like that is going to be a kind of a headwind here once they need to go borrow again.
Yeah.
Slash likely want to issue shares rather than borrow at these higher rates, right?
And just backing up one quick step before we talk about rates, one of the things that has been driving the buybacks in terms of the amount of buybacks from the companies has been the Mag 7, the big technology names. And what we found with this huge AI buildout is that a lot of that money that used to go for buybacks is now going to buy chips and to buy infrastructure and all that. So not only do we have the increased supply from the IPO from the SpaceX, we actually also have a lack of demand in terms of a buyback that used to be there that has now disappeared because the cash flow that was usually previously used for that buyback is now being used for AI spending. Now, in terms of your question about higher rates, there's two mechanisms that affect the stock market in terms of those rates. The higher rates should push prices down. One being what you mentioned, in fact, is that when companies go to borrow, now all of a sudden they're paying a higher rate. So when they pay a higher rate, there's less money, there's less profits, should be lower. But the other mechanism as well is that on a relative basis, suddenly with higher rates, an investor that previously felt like, oh, you know, when bonds were yielding 2%, didn't make any sense for me to buy bonds. I might as well go out and buy stocks. But now all of a sudden with bonds at, you know, in the US, 30 years at 5, maybe going even to 5.5, there are more of a competition for stocks. So on both aspects, we should be seeing the higher rates pushing down the price of the stocks. And I say should, because the reality is we haven't seen that. And in fact, I would contend that maybe even the opposite has happened. As bonds have gone down and that portfolio is no longer performing as well, you're seeing investors go, oh, geez, why am I owning these bonds? They don't do very well. And they sell them to buy the stocks going up. However, that behavior will eventually hit a spot where it'll go the other way. And so it's one of these things that for a little while, it's kind of steamrolls on itself. And so the fact that rates are going up means that people sell their bonds instead of buying more bonds. And then the fact that stocks are going up means that they buy more stocks instead of selling stocks. And we get that kind of reverse psychology kind of reaction function. But eventually what will occur is a pension fund, all the big money will sit there and say, listen, I'm trying to get, you know, an 8% all in yield. Now stocks are trading at insane PEs and these bonds are trading at very good rates. I'm going to buy bonds and I'm going to sell stocks. So far, we haven't seen that though yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things I've been thinking about quite a bit lately too is the lag effect with which, you know, a rate raise, for example, takes to kind of work itself into the economy, into the balance sheet of these companies. And with the, you know, the rise of yields, I've been trying to understand how that works as well, because of course the lag effect through all of these balance sheets takes time.
Yeah, for sure. And it's a little bit even more complicated because the reality, there's also something known as the credit spread, meaning that the rate upon which corporations borrow is the government risk-free rate plus a certain amount. And that certain amount has actually shrunk as there's been more willingness from investors to take risk. There's also something known as the equity risk premium. And if you stop and think about it, if you turn your stocks into an earnings yield, meaning like how much is it earning as a percent, right? So if you have a stock that's got a dollar of earnings and it's trading at $10, it's trading at a 10% earnings yield. If you go and put all those, and that's the reciprocal of PE. So as the price to earnings rises, your earnings yield will go down. And if you look at this thing called the equity risk premium, which is the difference in the earnings yield versus the risk-free rate. So it's in essence, how much are you earning more in stocks versus the risk-free rate? And the reason you should earn more in stocks is because stocks are riskier, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think about this equity risk premium, we go back to 2020 in the midst of the COVID crisis. We had a situation where the U.S., we'll stick with the U.S., the U.S. 10-year went down to, I don't know, what is 1% or something like that. And the earnings yield was up to, I can't remember if we do the earnings yield, the forecasted earnings yield, meaning the what they expected the stock market to earn. I can't, it was something like 5 or 6%, meaning that was the earnings yield. At that point, everyone was selling their stocks and buying bonds because they were scared. And yet the equity risk premium, meaning like how much more you earned by owning equities over risk-free assets, was huge. Now let's go and think about the opposite. We have a situation where the 10-year is 4.5 or whatever it is, and the earnings yield is, I think, below that. So we have a, so in fact, we have a situation where bonds are earning more than the stocks. And the reason that is because everyone's assuming stocks will go up forever. And this is one of the difficulties about the earnings, the equity risk premium, is that if you go and look and you plot the earnings risk premium versus the next year's return in stocks, it looks like it's like a shotgun blast, meaning like it's just random. There's no real relationship. There's none. So you say, well, what's the point in looking at the equity risk premium if there's no relationship? The thing is, if you take that same chart and you look at 10-year returns based upon where you start on the equity risk premium, it's almost a perfect, you know, relationship. Meaning the higher the equity risk premium, the more you're going to make, the lower the equity risk premium, the less you're going to make. So there's all sorts of things where you see strategists talk about this fact that they'll say that the returns for the next 10 years should be zero. And that's, I believe that that's roughly where we're at. A lot of these long-term models are indicating that if you own stocks for the next decade in the US, they should be a zero, you know, real return. The trouble is that that is over 10 years. And in the meantime, we have this bubble, this mania, and everyone's all excited about it. And can you really sit there and be underinvested while your neighbor's getting rich owning, you know, semiconductors?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think FOMO is certainly a big piece of the markets here. As you correctly mentioned, you see somebody else getting rich beside you. Before we kind of get to those other two pieces, Kevin, is there any type of seasonality that exists to you in the summer here. Like, I know with gold specifically, there's what they call the summer doldrums, yep, where everybody just kind of goes on vacation. It's not very exciting during the summer months. Is there a type of seasonality like that as well to you in the general stock
market? Well, in the stock market, sometimes you see August and September being some of the worst months around. Everyone has this vision that it's October because of the October crash of 1987. Mm-hmm. But I believe if you go look at it, long-term capital was in 98. I think that the worst month in the GFC was in September. A lot of times that there's a period in August and September that there's some real weakness. So there's a reason that sell in May and go away or whatever it is. Like, there's a reason that exists, is because that it has worked in the past. There is definitely some seasonality at the beginning of the year. And I've often noticed that the first month or two is just rocking. And especially it used to be, it would always rock in small caps. It's not that much anymore. But when you're thinking about the question about, you know, whether you should be taking seasonality and applying that in your investment makeup, I don't know if I would. I would just put it as part of the mosaic, but I would never say I'm going to be long or short because of seasonality only.
Yeah. Kevin, a concept that you and I have spoken about before is this idea of a series of mini rolling bubbles. Yeah. And it seems like no matter where we look, there are bubbles. So I guess inherent in the idea of a rolling bubble, yeah, is that just, do you look at it as the expansion of all of these different bubbles, or, you know, let's say an expansion and then a normalization at this new higher price level?
So, Tom, I was thinking about this as we had this semiconductor explosion, because it's absolutely insane what's gone on here. Like, these are huge companies. I was just pulling it up. Do you know that there's 14 companies now in the 4-comma club? And for those who don't know the 4 commas, that's a $1 trillion company. And by the way, when someone referred to it that, I remembered the 3-comma club. And I don't know if you watch Silicon Valley, but it's just an absolutely terrific show. And there's a character in there, Russ Hanneman, and he's all upset because he's I think he's supposed to be Peter Thiel or one of those guys. And he loses a couple $100 million and he thinks he's gone. He's destitute because he's no longer a member of the 3-comma club, because he can no longer call himself a billionaire. Anyway, so there's all these 14 companies in the 4-comma club. And let me just read you them just quickly. It's NVIDIA, Alphabet, Google, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Meta. Now we finally get to the first non-technology company, Saudi Aramco. Now we're back to technology, TSMC, Broadcom, Tesla, Berkshire, one of the non-technology companies, but don't forget, they have a huge Apple position. Samsung, SK Hynix, Micron Technology. Like, it is so stuffed with technology at the top. And so one of the things I was thinking about while we had this just mad rush into the Microns and the Samsungs and the SK Hynix and the Broadcoms and all these stocks, you know, over the last couple of months, I thought, you know, we've seen this before. And specifically, I just remember back to silver. Like, it wasn't that long ago, silver was doing the exact same thing. It just went vertical. And I kind of remembered back to when I coined that terms, a series of mini rolling mini bubbles. And it was actually in 2014. And I think it's only gotten worse since then. And you might say, well, you've named two, but there's been a ton of them. Just like, remember the electric car companies, how they went bananas when they went crazy. And like the AI stocks, we had Mag7 doing these things. And so more and more, we're seeing this behavior where the stock market gets a hold of an idea. Something's a good idea. It starts to rise, and then it starts to rise on its own. And then it seems to just go way, way further than anyone would ever imagine. right? Like that's the part that I just want to remember. Like I remember trading silver and I was long and I remember selling it and I was like $30 too early or something when I sold it because the reality was it just went vertical. And I think it's a function of our new environment that the way that the market operates. And when I think about like what this means going forward, like you asked, like, are these little mini bubbles going to come back down? And what does it mean? And I don't know how much they're going to correct on the other side. Like if we take silver, there's no doubt that like, you know, it gave up a good portion of the rally and then has gone sideways since then or roughly sideways. But in some of the other ones, like the EV bubble, sure, Tesla stayed bid, but everything else collapsed. So sometimes they look like true Eiffel Towers, like they go straight up and straight down. Other times there's kind of they go straight up, then they correct 50%, then go sideways. But one of the things that I've just kind of thought about in terms of how do I relate this to my trading, first of all, I gotta learn this, Tom. I keep making the same mistake. I get out too early. And then I might even try like to start betting against it. And I got to stop that because the reality is that the new environment, these things will go way farther than they ever imagined. The other thing is, instead of, you know, fighting one of these, why don't I look for the next one? And so one of my new goals in life is to say, what could be the next rolling mini bubble? And why don't I get in on it now? And that, I think, is a much more important question. And when I think about, in my mind, potentials, one of them is agriculture. Like we have a situation where you can make a great fundamental story. It hasn't gone anywhere. It's cheap. There's all sorts of things. It's a small market. And I'm going to go, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this won't be the next mini bubble. But I'm going to go out and buy some of those. The other thing is, you could just, instead of trying to pick it, you could just wait for it to show it to you. And almost like when you see something get some interest and starts to feel like it's a little frothy, instead of saying to yourself, oh, I'm going to short that, you should be like George Soros. Like his line is like, when I see a bubble, I run to buy it. Mm-hmm. Right. And that is in essence, probably the lesson that should be taken out of all these things is that when you see a bubble, you should run to buy it. And now, whether that has a function, whether that's a function of too much money in the system and a function of there's irresponsible government deficits and things of that nature, or whether it's a function of all the pod shops and all of the money and the fact that the fact that everyone has a on their phone the ability to trade. But regardless, mm-hmm. I just think you have to say to yourself, this is the new reality. We're getting these mini bubbles. Don't fight them. Look for them. Try to ride them. And then the most important thing is as they kind of get to that extreme phase, don't believe that like your crap doesn't smell. It's going to smell. It's taken too far. And I think the perfect example is the semiconductors. Anyone who thinks that they're buying up here and that these are going to be long-term great buys, they're deluding themselves. Like, and I can talk to you about why I think that specifically has happened and what the market is getting wrong there. But the risk reward is just all messed up. At this point, there is, sure, you can trade it. Sure, you can play it. And maybe it goes a lot, it gets even more vertical. But in terms of long-term investors, just be aware you're playing a game of musical chairs.
Kev, what role do you think the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet over the last, God, let's say 18 to 20 years-ish here, really has to play in the psychology of investors and the formation or expansion of all of these mini bubbles and the risk tolerance?
I'd love to blame the Fed for it. I know that that's a kind of popular viewpoint to take. Intellectually, I have trouble like blaming them too much. I believe that it has more to do with technology and the access to information and the computers and the fact that who we're trading against in terms of these pod shops. But there's no doubt that the Fed's expansion of balance sheet has probably changed the way that the markets behave. One of the things that I actually think is more harmful than most of my economic friends think is the fact that the Fed is so clear in terms of their forward guidance. Like, they purposely make it so that there's very little risk in the market, and that they go out of their way to signal a lot of things so that the market can lever itself up to the greatest degree. And one of the things that's interesting is that, I don't know if you remember back, but there used to be a Bank of Canada governor, Poloz, and he was one of the few central bank governors that was willing to surprise the market and do a rate move that was unexpected. And his argument was that that there should be some risk in that thing, because that should make it so that there's a cost in terms of that, in terms of borrowing at that window or doing something of that nature. And I'm kind of in that camp. I think that the Federal Reserve has made it too easy for people to speculate and has been too it's just made it too easy for everyone. And I do think that, I'm not a big Kevin Warsh fan, but one of the things that he's been talking about doing is removing guidance and removing some of all the speakers. I think that's a great idea. I think the curve should have some risk in it. And so although everyone wants to blame the size of the Fed's balance sheet as the real evil, I believe that the communication is actually at least as much of a problem, if not more.
Well, of course, there's always, I think, nuance to understand, and I appreciate you going into that nuance and explaining it from your viewpoint. But why is it that you're not a Kevin Warsh fan?
Oh,
and you know, what is the reason for that?
So, I think Kevin Warsh is very political, and that if you look at his behavior, it's not like I'm just newly not a Kevin Warsh fan. I haven't been a Kevin Warsh fan for a while, and it really started in 2018 when Jerome Powell got sworn in as the FOMC chair. At that point, Kevin Warsh and Stanley Druckenmiller, one of the market wizards, were going around talking about how the Fed was behind the curve, and that they was too easy, the monetary policy was too easy. And they were screaming and writing op-eds and a million things, you know, just trying to pressure the Fed into raising rates. So Powell went ahead and he did it. He started raising rates, and he in essence succumbed to their policy, or to their influence, I would say. You know, he didn't want to appear not tough, and he went and did it. And what happened was, we had this situation where he started raising rates, and all of a sudden the bond markets started getting in trouble, specifically corporate bond markets tightened up. And then Powell said this thing, he said, we're a long way from neutral. And that was like this terrible saying, because in essence, the bond market realized that he was still tightening a lot more. And we had this financial, you know, the financial conditions widened, and all of a sudden stock market went no bid. And at that time, I remember Warsh and Stanley Druckenmiller started writing op-eds about what an idiot he was, and how he was, you know, making such a mess, and that he immediately needed to cut rates. And I was like, you guys were the ones that were just, you know, advocating that this was a problem. And now all of a sudden you're saying that they have to go and cut rates the moment something goes wrong. And this was my problem with him, was that he was sitting around taking pot shots from the peanut gallery without really thinking about the long-term policy. And when you hear the more serious, Fed critics out there, they will put themselves in the Fed's shoes and talk about the what they did right and wrong, imagining they were in that same boat, it's too easy for Kevin Warsh to sit there and go, you're too loose, you're too tight, and he just screaming about all these things. And the reality is that, and we're going to see now how all the mistakes he makes, but he chases the market around, and that isn't what a central banker should do. So I have problems with that. I also have real problems with him and Moran and Bessent as well. They did all this crap where they went around talking about how the Fed was engaged, or sorry, the Treasury was engaging in stealth QE because Janet Yellen was issuing a whole bunch of T-bills instead of longer dated assets. And this story got huge play. And you talk to people, and they're like, yeah, Janet Yellen did all that T-bill issuance, and they'll talk about it. And I even had a good buddy that's a strategist, and he wrote about that. And I said, listen, you should go check your stats, right? Like, yes, she issued more T-bills, but go look at what's called the WAM, the weighted average maturity of the Treasury's balance sheet at the time. It was the longest it had ever been, meaning that the length of their borrowing had never been higher. So she was issuing more Treasury bills because it had lengthened too much. And nobody talks about this. And everyone just takes the soundbite that the Moran, Bessent, and Warsh crew spit out, and they take it as gospel. And I'm like, it's bullshit. Like, I have my criticisms of Jay Powell. I can tell you them, but I think that they're fair, and I can imagine myself having done something differently. Like, my criticisms are that two things. One was that when he started raising rates, he waited a month or two because he was worried about the fact that they were still doing QE, and he didn't want to be raising rates while they were doing QE. He thought it was sending mixed messages. I said that was bullshit. The reality was that you can raise rates and you can do QE at the same time. That's just a plumbing thing. And then the next thing I have problems with them is that they use QE as the, like, which is quantitative, easing as a policy tool, but they don't use quantitative tightening as a policy tool. It's not symmetrical, right? Like, you're sitting there and you'll be like, okay, the market's in trouble and the economy needs help. We're going to do quantitative easing. But then when the economy starts getting hot, they're like, no, we can't possibly use quantitative tightening as a policy tool. I'm like, again, BS. So I think those are two legitimate, proper criticisms, but to just like Warsh is, making crap up and then being Monday morning quarterbacking. I'm just a seller, and I'm just disappointed him, and like it's going to be interesting to see what he does now that he's actually in control of it. I think you're going to find that it's a lot of talk and that he's going to not be that much different than Jay Powell. Mm-hmm.
You know, as you bring up this issuance on the short end by Yellen, and I believe, as you mentioned, Bessent was a vocal critic of that.
Yep.
And yet he has issued all kinds of debt on the short end.
Well, not only that, he has outright said he would do that policy. Like, it's not even like it's he accused her of doing it and made it sound like this was the worst thing in the world. And now he's in control. He said, listen, we're going to do this. And he's been doing it. To be fair, he hasn't really reduced it in a huge way either, but he's put it on the table as a way to keep long end rates in check. Mm-hmm.
So what does that tool tell us right now, Kevin? Watching the short end of the curve, what is that indicative of, or is that a broken signal? Does it signal something else than it used to? Like, how is that useful to you?
That's a great question. And it's this war really messed things up. It really, like, in terms of the bond market and change things. And it's also an extremely difficult market because this K situation where we have like where the affluent are doing quite well, where their jobs are secure, their assets are going up. And then meanwhile, the lower end is having trouble finding jobs. The inflation is hurting them. They're doing terrible. This K has made it even more difficult because how do you tune the economy? Do you tune it for the lower end? Do you tune it for the upper end? And then also the tariffs. So never before has interest rate policy been as difficult as it is right now. So in terms of when you're asking about, you know, how does the Fed's policy affect me? It's difficult because in essence, I believe that the Fed is most likely just on hold. The reality is that it was one thing to take out cuts, which is what happened during the war. Like, let's just talk about what, you know, February 27th, the day, you know, the last day of trading before the war. At that point, there were three cuts priced into the next year's front end of the curve. Trump goes to war. All of a sudden, bonds go bananas. Now, all of a sudden, we have a situation where inflation is rising. And very quickly, those three cuts are completely taken out. And for those who don't know, although the stock market got into a little bit of trouble, it was really the main pain for hedge funds was at the front end of the curve, right? Because they were all betting that that Kevin Warsh was coming, he's going to be easy, the economy was going to roll over, AI was going to cause all these people to lose their jobs, and we're going to have a situation where we're going to have much lower rates going forward. So all of a sudden now, those three cuts are completely taken out. And to me, that was a relatively easy call, because it's one thing to not cut because of higher inflation. It's completely a different thing to actually raise rates, right? Mm-hmm. And even though it shouldn't be, because they're both affecting the economy, they're, in essence, if there's forward cuts priced in, then all those financial assets are based upon those forward cuts. So the fact that the front end rose 75 basis points should be the same as if it was at even and then they put in 75 points of cuts. But in reality, that's just not how psychologically people think about it. So we have this situation where now the Fed is just on hold. I think they're praying that they can just stay there, that will be enough for them, that they won't have to raise rates. I don't know in terms of what's going to happen going forward with the economy, because on the one hand, I understand and I see the economic strength and especially the financial asset strength that we're all seeing. And I could make the case that the Fed has not actually achieved their target and now we have higher inflation, so we should be raising rates. I get that argument. On the other hand, the reality is that if you have higher oil prices, raising rates isn't going to all of a sudden make it so there's more oil, right? You're not going to do anything. So you're purposely slowing down the economy because of this oil shock. And who's going to hurt from that? It's going to be the lower end. And is it really going to do anything? Like, what is the point of putting people out of their jobs because oil's higher? So I also understand that point of view. So when you're asking me how to discount it, I think I'm finding myself in a tough situation. I think a lot of people are finding themselves in a tough situation because I happen to believe the economy is about to roll over way more than most do. And I view the oil as a tax. If you think about like the average Joe, like they're paying more at the pump. That's less money that they have to spend. When you think about corporations, again, it's just increasing costs. Everywhere it's going up. And yes, I understand from a macro point of view, like the U.S. is even in terms of they're not an exporter or importer. They have all the domestic fuel. So realistically, it should be a wash. But the reality is it's Exxon and a bunch of other companies are going to be making a lot. That's not going to be positive for the economy as much as it's not going to offset. That positive for the economy is not going to offset the negative for the economy from the average Joe. So I'm very much in the opinion that we have a situation where the economy is about to roll over. But at the same time, it's not happening. We're not getting that unemployment spike higher. yeah, the unemployment, the jobs numbers aren't great, but they're not bad enough for them to cut. And yet you have this thing. So I think what the Fed's doing is they're just hoping that inflation doesn't take off too much and that the economy sits around here and maybe oil comes back down and then they'll be able to go back to lowering rates. But right now, it's tough. It's tough for them to do anything. And in fact, the longer this economy keeps showing signs of overheating through financial conditions, meaning like we see a situation where credit spreads are tight and where stock markets rallying and all these things are getting funded. We have exuberance out there. It really should be met with higher rates. So I don't know what to say. I'm beginning to wonder if we're actually going to get a hike that'll then be the final hike that pushes the economy back down and brings about those things. So Tom, I'm not answering your question very well, but the reality is that it's a difficult time. But I don't think that inflation is about to take off the way that people think it's going to take off. And if it does, I don't think it's going to feed upon itself. I think what we're going to see is that will be the final moment where that brings in the recession that has been looming out there for a while.
Mm-hmm. So you think that the demand destruction side is going to be quite significant and quite strong to be a countervailing force against continued inflation, right?
Correct. Correct. Mm-hmm. And the real key is, and we've talked about this before, fiscal policy is really what causes the inflation. Although I understand the arguments for lower rates causing inflation, that's when the elasticity is there in terms of how much people want to borrow. I don't think that we have the same sort of demand reaction function in terms of we lower rates that there's a ton of borrowing. Now, having said that, we have to talk about this AI a little, because my gut tells me that this is really the crux of the problem, is that if we took out AI, the U.S. economy would be very clearly rolling over and we'd be in trouble. So then we have to ask ourselves, okay, we have this AI boom. What does it mean? How long is it going to go? And what are the chances that it rolls over? Because if it rolls over, then I'm in the lower rates camp. Like if we get a situation where all of a sudden this ends up being a mirage, I'm in the lower rates camp. So you have to ask yourself, what's going on in AI? And there's a fellow by the name of Warren Pies from 314 Research. And I have to give him all the credit in the world, because he has this chart that he does, and it shows the GPU usage. Like there's all these GPUs for AI that you can rent. And so what he does is he queries them and figures out like how much they're getting rented and whether there's any availability. I guess he doesn't measure usage. He measures availability. So when availability drops to zero, that means that it's all being used up. Okay.
Yeah.
And what he found was that starting at the beginning of January, there was all of a sudden a marked uptick in the amount that was used and a decline, basically the availability went to zero. And so one of the reasons he got bullish even in the midst of the war was he was like, something's going on with this AI. Like they're just using all of this GPU. And he correctly got bullish. And I have to give him all the credit in the world. Now, when I've been thinking about this, trying to understand this, I've recently come to the realization that if you go look at companies like Meta, Microsoft, Amazon, they went and put AI usage as a goal for their engineers. Like they measured it. Like there was a talk about Meta having a leaderboard in who was using AI the most, right?
Right.
So you have these companies that all of a sudden said, we want everyone to use AI. Like we want, not only do we want everyone to use it, you're forced to do it. Like if you're not using it 80%, then there's something wrong. Okay. And You know, what's that? Is it Charlie Munger that says, show me the incentives and I'll show you the behavior or whatever it is?
Show you the outcome.
Yeah, the outcome. That's right. You make all of your employees use it. And sure enough, there's stories about guys just making it like make work projects. Like they weren't actually using it for their coding. They were just trying to figure out ways to like get it to go. And what I'm worried about is when I've listened to all these stories, and one of the things is you don't get those stories from the financial guys. You actually have to go to the tech guys, because the finance guys are just want to talk to you about how usage is, you know, going through the moon and there's no availability and how this demand is never ending. You have to actually go listen to the tech guys. And when you listen to the tech guys, they'll say, this is insane. These companies are using way too many of these tokens. They're doing it in an inefficient manner. It's just a make work project. And already we're seeing changes. Microsoft yesterday or 2 days ago announced that they were changing their AI usage because it was so high. Like there's that fellow that made the OpenClaw, and he I don't know if you know what this is some sort of it's some sort of project that he created. And it was so your computer could do all these things on its own, right? And it was a huge deal. Yep. And so he got hired by OpenAI. And he went to OpenAI and he had free reign to do whatever he wants. And he ended up spending $1.4 million in tokens in like 3 days. Like just because like, right? And it was just kind of an experiment he tried to do. But I was like, $1.4 million? So he just blew $1.4 million for nothing? Like, And so one of the things I worry about is that we've had this strange push by all these companies to go and to force their engineers to do it. And I'm not sure that it's going to be a long-term proper use of AI. And I use AI. I actually love it for programming. It's made my, like I'm a hack programmer, so it's perfect for me. So I'm not going to say that it's unusable or that it's not something that's going to be good, but I worry about the signal that was sent at the beginning of the year. And I worry about this Warren Pies. And yes, he has got it correct. He went and he bought all these things because he recognized that all this AI usage was going through the roof. But yeah. What if we're vastly overstating and forecasting way more demand than there really is? And I really worry about this. And I think that there's more of a chance of a huge bust up and problem here in the AI going forward. And I read you those 14 stocks, there's two of them are non-tech, right? And so when people own the index, they're going to own all these things. And I don't think the most folks understand the risks that they're taking, and they understand how much they've become exposed to this industry. And going back to it all, Tom, I'll just say this: back in 2022 and 2023 and 2024, a lot of people would ask me if the stock market was going to crash, and I always used to say, no, the stock market's not going to crash. They go, why are you so sure? And I go, because you're asking. Like, the reality is that crashes occur when no one's expecting it, when everyone's very excited about it. And that's what creates the conditions that actually allow for the crash. When everyone's worried about something, that is when you shouldn't be worried about it. And geopolitics, I should have learned this, and I didn't learn it as well as I should have, because anytime that geopolitics is on the headlines and everyone's talking about it, you should be going the other way, because it's already in the price of the stock. So we saw that once again with this, Strait of Hormuz thing. I personally thought that it was so bad because of, oil, that this was the time it was different. And no, it's not. This, it's never different. So the reality is that if everyone's worried about something, you shouldn't be worried about something. And when no one's worried about something is when you should be worried about it. And so I look at this situation with this AI, and it's a great technology. I'm not disputing the technology. I'm not disputing how much it's gonna affect the world. What I'm saying is that it is more than fully priced in. And one of the things that I just want people to know is if you come and say to me, but it really truly is amazing. And I say, the more that something is amazing, the more likely it's going to be a bubble that gets mispriced, because of the reality is the more amazing and game changing it is, the more money that gets allocated to it. And so I worry very much that this last 3 months of GPU usage has been a complete mirage, and that once we get all these companies pulling back on it, all of a sudden we're going to go, whoa, the demand was not there. It's just like back in the dot-com bubble when everyone expected there's a certain amount of internet growth. And it was, you know, what people don't realize is that the internet didn't stop growing. In fact, it continued to grow. It just didn't grow as fast as everyone thought it was going to grow. And there was this moment where they realized that they were making too much of it in terms of the fiber. And then it all just collapsed in and on itself. And I hate to be someone that's talking about something negative when everyone's partying and having a great time, but that's the moment you should actually be the most worried.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like that dovetails nicely. The usage idea dovetails nicely with this kind of circular profit sharing that all these AI companies and hardware companies have been kind of pushing around.
Yeah. And it's one company owns another company that is, you know, I'll give you money so you can buy more of my chips and then I'll have more of your things. And there's a million different things like that that are occurring. And not only that, if you stop and think about, you've been talking a lot about companies borrowing more and the effect on it. And that has been occurring hugely in terms of the Mag 7. If we stop and think about what happens when they go and they all of a sudden they borrow money to build another infrastructure in terms of the AI, they borrow money. Everyone assumes that that money is going to earn the same rate of return that it's earned in the past, right? And not only that, that money, so when they do that, they increase their earnings, but yet the earnings are still out in the future. So they increase their forecasted earnings because everyone says, okay, they're going to earn whatever it is. Let's just say 25% on this infrastructure. So therefore they're borrowing $1 billion so I can add that amount to their earnings. So they increase their earnings in the future and then they go buy all these things, which increase the earnings today of NVIDIA, right? And all the companies that they're buying all the chips for. And then not only that, when the earnings, so the first company gets an increased multiple, the second company gets the NVIDIAs of the world that are selling it get an increased multiple. So it's a self kind of reinforcing positive feedback loop where everyone just keeps getting higher and higher multiples. And the reality is, if you think about that and then also put a little bit of game theory in there in terms of their worry about AGI, and the fact that they're concerned that there might be something out there that actually makes their company no longer relevant, and therefore they have to make sure that they're part of it just to make, like, if by some fluke they come up with AGI, they better be there, because if they're not, their company's gone. You have this feedback loop that is, in hindsight, I should have been more expecting a bubble than I did. And maybe I'm making the, like, I'm sitting here saying this and the reality is the bubble is going to get way worse, and it could very well be. So I'm not trying to sell you tomorrow that it's going to get in, you know, that'll be the top. But I do know that playing in here is increasingly risky and the downside is not being adequately appreciated.
Mm-hmm. And I think to your previous point about this, the geopolitical issues that we're facing right now, you know, obviously the war in Iran has dominated headlines and things like that. And I was discussing this with a couple friends yesterday and I stepped back and thought, it seems like we're just in this like Schrodinger's peace, no peace state. Is this to you like just like a distraction at this point?
I had a discussion with someone the other day. I happen to think that this on again, off again has actually been good for the market. Like, the market likes to climb a wall of worry. And I know it makes no sense and I can't defend it logically, right? Because someone said the other day, well, imagine how high we would be if he hadn't gone to war. And I kind of think, yeah, okay, I understand that argument and I have no good reason to push back on that. But a little part of me wonders that if somehow this on again, off again is actually more conducive to encouraging people to speculate and to get even more out there and encourage more confidence. I could be wrong. I don't know, but I do think it's frustrating. And I can tell you one thing, Tom, that a lot of people are very, very tired of the headline, like tape bombs that you keep getting, right? You just, yep. you wake up one day, everything's going great. And then all of a sudden, boom. And then next thing you know, it's back up, boom. And I guess maybe that's why if the market's easier to move around because there's less people that are willing to you know, take a view. I'm not sure. But I do know that a lot of people are very tired of it. And I hear you that it's been a very difficult time to trade for a lot of folks. Even the bulls are feeling tired. Mm-hmm.
I had a discussion with Doomberg the other day, who's, you know, spent, I guess, the beginning of his career as an oil analyst. And he was telling me that oil markets and analysts typically lie. They all lie. And I re-listened to this part, and he was telling me about the idea that there was a massive glut of oil coming into the war. China had been stockpiling, and it's basically much better for the industry to be burning off this excess inventory at, you know, around $100 a barrel than at $30 a barrel. And his kind of prediction was that likely by the time this excess inventory is kind of worked off, that is going to be the time that peace finally prevails, or that's a possibility.
Okay. What do you, you want me to, I'm probably more bullish on oil in the longer term than Doomberg is. I think wasn't he on in the $20, it's going back to $20 camp, right? Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case. I think that, first of all, this has introduced a change in everyone's need to stockpile more resources. So that's the first thing. It's not just oil, by the way. This is the whole world, right? This has changed everything. If you're sitting there, and we used to count on just-in-time inventories, we used to count on being able to buy whatever we want. And now all of a sudden, it's put all these things up in the air. And yes, the market has been amazingly flexible at dealing with it so far. I hope that continues. But regardless, if you're sitting there and you're China, first of all, you have to go and buy back all the SPR that you used. Even the US has to do that. And not only that, think about, like, if I'm sitting there and I'm like Canada, even I'm like, oh, I better have my own SPR. If I'm Europe, I better have my own SPR. And it's not just this, it's in fertilizer, it's in copper, it's in everything has become less the surety of being able to just buy something in the open market has decreased. And so what does that mean? That means everyone has to hold more. So there's a huge demand from that. Okay. So that's one aspect of it. Then not only that, let's think about what we're all going to have to do. We're all going to have to build more Navy. We're going to have to build more war. This has become so when the bond bears that tell me this is hugely inflationary, I get it. I understand from a societal point of view, it makes us all less rich, because if you have a certain amount of wealth and now all of a sudden you need to take part of that wealth to have an army on standby, you have to go and put some of that to have boats that are not really actually creating anything for you. They're just insuring what used to be free. And so I'm of the opinion that this is probably more of a game changing development than a lot of people appreciate.
Mm-hmm. Kevin, one of the things that you and I have spoken about before is your bullishness on Japan.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming into having our discussion this morning, I started thinking about it and wondering if that calculus tends to change because of the higher oil price and how dependent they are on all of their energy imports and how that ends up affecting their, let's say, government balance sheet because of that?
So it's a great question, Tom. And if we were to say at the beginning of this war, what would Japan have done? You would have said it should be way down, right? Meanwhile, it's hitting all-time highs, right? As we speak, it's hitting all-time highs. Some of that has to do with the fact that they are a more technology company, based index. So therefore, they're going to have more increases. I worry about all the Japan doom guys out there, and there's a lot of them. And I don't know, there must be a whole bunch of them, you know, out making the rounds recently, because I've been getting a lot of questions. Are you still bullish Japan? Like, you know, blah, blah, blah is talking about the end of their carry trade or whatever and all this. Like, there's all sorts of worries out there. And yeah, okay, I get it. I understand. I know all the worries. First of all, back to my original point. The fact that you're worried about it means that you probably shouldn't be, because that probably in the price. But in terms of, if that's not good enough for you, why is this not a worry? I'm hesitant to say that the higher rates are going to be bad for Japan, because I think a lot of people don't appreciate that although their debt outstanding is quite high, the Bank of Japan owns half of it. It's not as bad as everyone thinks. Like, they don't understand that point of view. They also don't realize that the currency is just dirt cheap. It's dirt cheap. Like, so the reality is that if they need money to fund things, their ability to fund whatever they want to do is huge. Their financial position is one of the best in the world, right? And so everyone says, well, why are you worried about Japan? Like, you know, the US is doesn't have all these concerns. And I'm like, the US is running the largest current account deficit in history. If people stop sending the US money tomorrow, it's a huge problem. So they have let's go through the US. They have an overvalued currency. They have an overvalued stock market. They have a situation where the most investors are overweight their market and their economy, and they are the largest portion of the world's assets. So, yeah, I get it. I understand why they've gone there and why this is happening. But having said that, when it comes to competing in the forward, you know, going forward, you don't want to buy necessarily the most expensive thing. You want to buy the thing where something's going to change to the positive. So Japan is cheap in terms of the currency. They have tons and tons of savings. And all they would have to do in terms of, you know, if they needed to fund some of their government programs, or if, let's say, the bond market started to get unruly, all they would have to do is take the GPIF, which is the world's largest pension plan, and say, right now they have the strangest asset allocation out there. It's a quarter stocks domestic, a quarter stocks foreign, a quarter bonds domestic, and a quarter bonds foreign. All they would need to do is say, okay, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take like half those bonds in the US and we're going to bring them back home. And the numbers are so large that a lot of these problems immediately go away. So I'm much more worried about the country that needs a constant inflow of capital as opposed to the country that has the constant inflow of capital. And I think what you're going to see is, if you look back at Korea, they did this little stunt on December 24th when the U.S. was all busy worried about their Christmas Eve, just to make sure that Trump wasn't paying too much attention. They changed it so they made it so that domestic investors had a tax incentive to bring money home.
Right.
And they did this change on December 24th. And look what the stock market did. Look what it did to their stock market. Now, granted, there's more going on. I get it. There's still, you can't isolate it perfectly. But my point is that I'm more interested in who has the savings, where it will go. I still contend that at the end of the day, we're going to see savings come back home to various countries. and those countries, and because they're all going to be spending more, and those countries with financial savings abroad are going to be the ones that whose local economies do the best. And so I'm not worried about Japan as much as the doomers out there.
Interesting. Well, Kevin, it's always a fascinating conversation to, you know, walk through all these different areas that, you know, like Japan, all these different things. Is there anything that you would say, let's say, is you're overly pessimistic or overly bullish about right now? One thing that's, let's say, dominating your mind.
Well, I'm pretty negative on the semiconductors and the AI. I really think that there's going to be an accident there, and that it's going to be difficult for that to, for these prices to be justified. And although I do understand all the bull reasons, that how it's cheap on a PE, I worry also about the concentration risk, which I brought up and things like that. But I guess I'll finish with, I know your listeners love the gold. Let's talk a little bit about gold. I've noticed recently a lot of folks are getting a little bearish. I don't know if you noticed this, like that there's a lot of like people getting frustrated, and I've heard about people on the sell side. I will say this. I still think the reason to own gold is because in the long run, the People's Bank of China is going to have to take all their savings and they have to bit by bit move it out into other assets. Because they can't just own a whole bunch of U.S. treasuries. And although I understand why gold has gone down during this Gulf War, because countries that also save in gold needed to pay for stuff, like Turkey was a big seller, and you know, some of the Gulf states were sellers. I still think that in the long run, if you step back and think about this geopolitical event that has occurred in the Strait of Hormuz with Iran, that has made China probably even more confident that they need to go and diversify out of U.S. assets. So that's the reason to own gold. And I know that there's a lot of people that are worried about rates going higher at the front end and all these things. Don't forget that whole relationship of rates and U.S. dollar versus gold. I wrote a piece about this, but I'll just remind everyone that broke down. And I don't think it's coming back. I don't think that that's going to be what drives gold in the coming years. It hasn't in the last few years, and I don't think it's going to come back. At the margin, at times it does, right? Because if you're a U.S., you know, investor, then those things do matter. But the main reason to own gold is because China is going to continue buying it. I don't think that's going away. And if we get a situation where it actually gets in trouble and gets down to 4,000 or somewhere around there, I would definitely just keep buying it. I continue to love it. And as a little aside, I suspect that the gold miners, like their earnings have been going sideways. There's been a lot of worries about the fact that diesel is one of their big inputs, like energy in terms of mining. As that worry lessens, hopefully, as this situation, you know, resolves itself in the Gulf. As that worries lessens, I suspect that what you're going to see is a re-rating back higher on the gold stocks. Mm-hmm. And not only that, I think we're going to have some M&A, and that you're going to see some real, like, I'm not smart enough to go pick the little guys, but if you're a stock picker, I think this will be a great time for you to be owning assets, because a lot of these bigger, larger gold mining companies haven't had an ability to grow in a long time. And that they're going to be wanting to expand, and they'll be taking advantage of it. Mm-hmm.
I think that plays in really nicely to kind of reiterate that idea of being worried about what others aren't. And, you know, that opposite type of psychology. Yeah. I think that's one of the biggest lessons I've learned over the last 2 years here, is really trying to challenge, okay, my head is saying this, I have to do the exact opposite. Yeah,
you have to withstand it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, silver's at $120. There's no way it's going to. Oh, wait, yeah. That's exactly when you needed to take profits, right? Yeah. And in a case where, you know, as we're recording this, we're hovering around $44.50 US for the gold price. It's gone down today. I think that, you know, if it makes you kind of sick and you're like, oh, why isn't this performing? This is the perfect geopolitical environment for gold. Then why don't you love it more?
Yeah.
In this case, yeah. Right? If you're being presented with this opportunity, you should see it as an opportunity.
100% agree with you there, Tom. I always go when someone is on Twitter and saying something dumb, don't sit there and argue with them. Just go, thank you very much for, because in essence, their viewpoint that you believe is wrong is giving you the necessary preconditions to give you an opportunity. If we all agreed and we all saw the same things, then everything would be perfectly priced and there would be no opportunities. Yeah. So welcome the people that disagree with you. I'm sure there's lots of people going, I'm a complete idiot, not understanding AI. And all I can say to you is, great, you should buy all the more then, because you know what? If I were long it and doing it, it would be even higher. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I gave up on arguing with people on Twitter a long time ago. But they are good indicators.
They are great indicators, yeah.
Kevin, it's always a pleasure, man. Of course, for anybody that wants to check out Kevin's extensive and very frequently posted Substack, that's available at themacrotourist.com. And of course, you do the Market Huddle show as well. Kevin, always a pleasure, man. Thanks so much for your time today.
Oh, my pleasure. Always great chatting with you. Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.